This isn't gonna work.
Nope, I hate it.
Okay, no, we're not doing this. I want my seat.
I just felt.
That's a lot better.
I did feel small. I felt smaller in that seat.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I felt smarter though.
All right, that checks out.
There's that.
There's that.
Well, hello and welcome to the Back to Basics podcast. This is a podcast where me, Jason Seitz, a paramedic and RN, and my brother, Christopher Seitz, a ER physician, CEO, and father of three.
What?
I mean, that's all true.
Yeah, it's true. Just details people didn't really need.
What we do here on this podcast is we take complicated medical topics, we break them back down to the basics to make them digestible for you.
Yep. The Back to Basics podcast is hosted by Guardian MD. Guardian MD is a digital health platform that helps nurse clinics and non-physician run clinics with medical oversight and compliance. So we provide medical directors and compliance resources so that every provider can have a practice to increase access to care. So if you or someone you know is interested in starting our own healthcare clinic or business or needs oversight compliance resources, check out guardianmd.com.
Awesome. And you can listen to this podcast at guardiancme.com for free EMS and nursing CE credits.
Correct.
Unless you're listening to it right when this comes out, in which case you're going to have to wait like probably a month or so before there's nursing CME credits. Right. We're working on the nursing CME side. We have the accreditation. This will be a credit. This will be an hour-long credit for both EMS and for nurses. Just give me some time, guys. It's just been hard.
So if you're listening to this and it came out a couple months ago, then you can listen to it for free credits.
Exactly.
Yep, got it.
Exactly.
Cool. So what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to be talking about antibiotics and antibiotic resistance and kind of the threat of antibiotic resistance.
Okay.
We have talked a little bit about antibiotic resistance before when we've talked about treatments for other conditions. And we've mentioned this a few times, but we've never really like kind of narrowed in on the topic of antibiotic resistance. So sure. The goal of today is to basically cover a couple things. One is for the listener to understand antibiotics and their mechanism of action, kind of how antibiotics work,
mm-hmm.
Get a little brief history on antibiotics and how they came about, differentiate between antibiotics and like what an antiviral would be and kind of like how these different infections work and why can't I just, you know, make COVID disappear by taking zithromycin kind of thing. And we want to talk a little bit about antibiotic resistance and why that's so dangerous and what happens if we're not properly, as a society, we're not properly using antibiotics, how that can be a true danger to public health.
I think that's something that people hear about a lot. So you hear about, like, at least as a physician, I know I run into a lot of times with patients where patients get frustrated because they're like, well, I just need an antibiotic. And it's like, well, no, you don't. Or we need to wait. And they're like, why the heck would my doctor make me wait to take an antibiotic? Hopefully we'll get into some of that today. As you learn about what antibiotics truly do and how they work, it starts to make a lot more sense why we have to be careful how we, I guess, almost like steward them in a way. Yeah. Because honestly, antibiotics are probably one of the greatest healthcare, findings or inventions that has really ever happened, honestly, in a lot of ways. Like, I'd mark it up there with insulin. Like, before this, people just died, right? Before this, people just died. Well, however you feel about vaccines, either way, I mean, like, we're not going to get into, like, the political side of, like, that. We're just going to talk about what things do here mm-hmm. today. I did have a patient, though, one time. I mean, I'll just be honest. Like, I'm very pro-vaccine as a...
We're talking about antibiotics today, not vaccines, though.
No, I know. But I was just going to tell a story about, like, where I had a patient who's, this, again, if you don't want your kids to get vaccines, it's perfectly fine. But they were like, what, I don't want my kid to get this vaccine. I said, sure, no problem. Like, I'm not going to argue with you. Like, that is your right as a person. Like, if you don't want your hypertensive medication, you don't have to take that either. Like, sure. Maybe diet and exercise is better for you. Perfectly fine with that. I recognize both sides of that coin. But she was like, I mean, like, for example, like, what did we do before vaccines?
We died.
And let me be honest with you, like, people died a lot more. So, and same with antibiotics. Like, before antibiotics, way more people died. And that's okay. I'm just throwing that out there. Like, if you've never lived in the world, as I have not, where antibodies don't exist, if you read a book about history, people died a lot more. So just going to throw that out there.
Crazy, too, is, like, when you look at the history of this, like, when penicillin, we'll talk about it, but when penicillin first came out, like, and it started to be employed, like, people called it the miracle drug. Like, they thought it could treat everything and anything because it would treat a bacterial infection. It's a broad spectrum antibiotic that treated bacterial infections, which was killing, killing people all the time. And if you, what's crazy is this just wasn't that long ago. And I mean, that we're talking World War II.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking like, you know, Oppenheimer. If you saw Oppenheimer, that period of time, penicillin is relatively new.
Right.
Actually really new.
Mm-hmm. Not as new if you watch the Barbie movie.
What?
In the Barbie movie, they definitely had antibiotics at that time.
It depends on where you side. If you're an Oppenheimer person or a Barbie person.
Right, yeah. I think right now that's a very important distinction to make.
Some people are doing the Barbenheimer thing. Have you seen either of them?
No, I've seen neither.
I saw Oppenheimer, and I thought it was an excellent movie, but I was... This is going to make me sound like a terrible person. I was disappointed by the explosion. So they don't... First of all, they don't show the explosion... They show the test explosion. It's not like anyone's like reveling in like this horrible thing that happened.
Yeah, right?
But they show the test explosion, and kind of like part of the gimmick of like getting people in those seats was supposed to be, it's supposed to be like in IMAX. It's going to be this like spectacular scientific, you know, boom, like this big boom kind of thing. And it's just kind of like zoomed in picture of a flamethrower. Like it's a zoomed in picture of fire. I don't know. I didn't think it was that great.
The movie or just the explosion?
The explosion in the movie. I just thought that the hype around that, like, it's just a drama. It's a very
That in real life, the explosion was probably pretty spectacular.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm saying. In a fine way. No, I mean, we're talking about the test explosion. I don't want to comment on the actual explosion.
Okay, fair.
All right, anyway, let's get back to antibiotics. So, first thing to understand, which I think if we really want to break this down back to basics, is there were like four or five ways that you can get sick, right? So... bacterial infections are only one of several ways that you can get sick.
True.
So that's why antibiotics don't work on everything, because you could be getting sick from something that's not a bacteria, and antibiotics kill or slow the growth of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So some ways that you can get sick. You can get a bacterial infection. So a pathogen, a living creature, an organism that is dangerous to your body, gets into your body and starts reproducing and causing issues with your body function. Most bacteria are healthy bacteria. Most bacteria in the world are not dangerous to the human body.
Right. And actually, most bacteria are in a lot of ways like symbiotically helpful to, like, if you didn't have bacteria in your gut, you couldn't digest foods. If you didn't have bacteria on your skin, the bad bacteria would grow way more rapidly. So, and this is where you'll hear people argue about, like, antiseptic, you know, what am I trying to talk about?
Like hand sanitizer.
Yeah, like hand sanitizer stuff. Like that kills the good bacteria too. So do you have to be careful that you use it? Again,
my doctor said stop drinking it.
Really?
Because it'll kill the healthy bacteria in my gut.
Oh, yeah, you don't
stop drinking all the hand sanitizer I drink. And I was drinking like a liter of hand sanitizer a day.
I've met some people who drink hand sanitizer in the emergency department for different reasons, but...
So yeah, bacterial infections are a threat to your body. That is one way that you can get sick, but it's not the only way you can get sick. Other ways that you can get sick are viral infections.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a virus is not a living organism in the same way that bacteria is.
Mm-hmm.
It has DNA and RNA. Kind of depends on like what you want to call life, you know, but it's basically like a organic. I don't even know if I can say that. It's like a program almost. It's hard to explain.
It's just like a virus.
Well, viruses are very different in that they don't have a cell wall. They work differently. Bacteria is basically something that's going to get into the body and reproduce. A virus is actually going to inject itself. It needs a host, so it's going to inject itself into your cells in order to reproduce when it explodes your cells.
Well, I think that's the difference between a bacteria and a virus, right?
Yeah.
A bacteria can live on its own. It's like it's a living organism on its own, and a virus can't. It has to have some type of host.
Yeah.
Right?
Kind of like a parasite, but not a parasite.
Parasites are another way you can get sick, though.
Yes. You can get a parasite.
Mm-hmm.
It's another living organism that is feeding off you in some sort of harmful way.
And then also you can get sick or have an illness that's from even your own body's inappropriate response to certain things.
Yeah, so immune response, genetic disorders, things that don't function correctly, that's other ways that you can get sick, right? So in medicine, we talk about getting you better from being sick, and we talk about getting you better from being injured, and that's kind of, you know, but when we're talking about pharmacology, we're usually giving medication to either improve the body's function because there's dysfunction there, or to fight a disease that is generated by a fungal infection. We didn't say fungus, but that's another one. Fungal infection, bacterial infection, viral infection, or just a poor body function, or your own body isn't doing great, right?
So today we're talking about antibiotics, though, which are only for bacteria.
Right.
Also, worth making a note of, is that the majority of like common illnesses that healthy people get are viruses. Mm. And I say that because this is where there's a lot of confusion, I think. And you guys who are listening, who are healthcare professionals, see this probably every day too. Most people believe that if they get sick, if they get an upper respiratory infection, if they have a cough, a sneeze, a runny nose, that kind of thing, that it must be bacterial. That's actually not true. The majority of the time it's viral, which is why doctors say, no, I'm not going to give you an antibiotic yet. I'm going to wait and see, because your body should be able to fight that virus off perfectly fine on its own.
Exactly.
And we'll talk about antibiotic resistance and why we need to be careful how we're using our antibiotics.
Exactly. And that's where, so this should sort of frame the reference a little bit. Was penicillin a miracle drug? Absolutely. Is it going to treat your gout? No. Right. So like, that's not a disease process that's caused by a bacteria. So it's not going to fix everything, but it's wonderful that it can take out quite a bit of bacterial infections. So let's have a little bit of a historical review of how we came about discovering antibiotics.
Like most things in medicine, completely by accident.
Kind of. So with respect, Alexander Fleming is kind of accredited as the father of antibiotics because he, quote-unquote, invented or discovered penicillin. Mm-hmm. But there was someone before that found some things. You want to tell the audience about it?
Sure. So 1909. This is about 20 years before Alexander Fleming, Paul Ehrlich.
Ehrlich, I think.
Oh, sorry. Ehrlich.
It's like the Third Reich.
Oh, don't.
He was a German.
Okay. So anyway, he discovered arsphenamine. I don't know what arsphenamine is. It's just like a chemical, as far as I can tell, that was effective in treating syphilis. I don't know how he found that out.
So here's the thing is I don't want to misquote or anything like that, but I think I'm pretty sure he was credited with saying, oh, Fräulein,
what?
Does genitals as squeaky clean after asphenamine was given?
No, that you is I mean?
Something along those lines. It wasn't exactly that, but I think he said something along those lines after he discovered it.
Absolutely not true.
I don't know what's so funny about a German accent. I think German accents are just...
I don't think that's hilarious. A real German accent. I think if you talk to a real German, they yeah, like, I guess funny it's like, German accent. Like, that's not, yeah. You know...
It's like the Inglourious Bastards version.
Yeah, right.
Jeez. But, yeah, anyway. So anyway, yeah, he actually referred to that treatment as chemotherapy because it was using chemicals
to treat something.
It was kind of the first time using chemicals to fight a disease process, right?
Sure.
So it wasn't until like 30-ish years later, well, not even, within the next few years that Selman Waksman, a microbiologist, coined the term antibiotics. And then he, over the next 30 years, discovered like 20.
Oh, nice.
A bunch. I made up 20. More than 12.
So Selman Waksman discovered a bunch of antibiotics, but during that time, Alexander Fleming specifically discovered penicillin.
Which is like...
He got the good one.
Which again is the miracle drug, right? And how he did it, like you said, completely out of accident, right. Sort of, right? So Alexander Fleming didn't really keep a very clean lab. He wasn't very careful with his, you know, separation of things. And when he got back from like a holiday, that's what they call it back then. They'd call vacations holidays. Mm-hmm. So when he got back from a holiday...
They still call him that.
No, actually, the article may have said he was actually returning home from the holidays. But you'd be taking a holiday, too.
Sure.
But anyway, he showed up at home after a while had passed, went down to his lab, and he found that he had a culture plate of Staphylococcus infection.
So was he trying to find antibiotic? I mean, is he... Like,
I don't know. I don't want to say it because I don't know.
Okay. So anyway, he had some petri dishes with some bacteria in it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Fun. I mean, I'm sure he was...
Doing something.
He's like a microbiologist. Yeah. So... He's studying Staphylococcus. It's sitting there. He also had this fungus that had grown. And basically, what fungus was it? Oh, Penicillium notatum was a fungus that basically had like gotten on his culture plate. And he noticed that in areas where this fungus passed into it, there was areas on that culture plate that didn't have any bacterial like growth there.
It's kind of cool. This is still today how we like check to see if bacteria is susceptible to an antibiotic. Mm-hmm. You get the bacteria,
petri dish,
put it on a petri dish, and then you put these little like discs of like penicillin and methicillin and
Zithromycin,
like on the thing, and see if the bacteria don't grow around it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't grow around it, it means, oh, that'll work.
Yeah.
And then the lab calls and says, yeah, Dr. Seitz, azithromycin should work for that.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of cool.
So, yeah, he saw that this, like, mold was basically growing on it, and it was eliminating the bacterial growth. So then he created penicillin out of that.
So, Jason, does that mean that fungus can treat bacteria?
No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that the chemicals derived from the fungus is what kills the bacteria. Don't, like, take mushrooms in the woods and rub them into your wounds thinking that you're going to prevent, like, it's going to be an antiseptic in some way.
Yeah. Right? But if you want to take mushrooms in the woods, you know, all power to you.
You share too much. So anyway, what he did was he isolated and grew that mold, and then he did human trials on wounds. So specifically, like, infections that were growing in wounds, he would, you know, drop this chemical into.
Which is, and then, so Staphylococcus, the one that he, like, found penicillin to initially be susceptible to, right, is a very common wound bacteria.
Yes. So then he worked with pharmaceutical companies to make penicillin. And again, just clarifying, penicillin is a chemical produced by the fungus. It's not the fungus itself. The fungus is Penicillium notatum.
Got it.
So don't, like, go in the woods and try to find Penicillium notatum. I don't know why I'm assuming this fungus would be in the woods, but
yeah, maybe,
but that's, to me, where fungi is.
So, always.
So yeah, that is kind of how that came to be. Once he made penicillin, by, like, the time we were storming the beaches of Normandy, 1944 or something like that. Yeah, 44. It was a very well-known drug that was being used in the war to treat bacterial infections and saved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lives.
Yeah.
So that's where it was kind of started to be coined the miracle drug. And then we started developing other studies from that. What's really interesting is before we get into, like, antibiotic resistance and stuff, what's happening right now is, like, as bacteria adapts and becomes resistant to certain, there are, like, teams of researchers that are going out into, like, the jungle, the desert, and, like, trying to find unique.
So we can talk about this later. It's a little
good bacteria.
Yeah, it's a little scary that, like, we developed between, like, the 1930s and 1950s a bunch of antibiotics, and, like, haven't really found any more since. And we'll get to it at the end. Like, that's why we have to be so careful with the antibiotics we have. That there is concern that a world could exist where all bacteria is resistant to all of our current antibiotics and we're not developing any
all
new
pathogenic
ones.
Bacteria. Yeah, like the ones that are killing us.
Bacteria, yeah. Like the bad stuff that makes you sick, that all of a sudden it's all resistant to all of our antibiotics and we haven't really created or developed any new ones, and now we're back to. So again, to answer your question, if you feel like, well, I don't need antibiotics, my body can handle it, what did we do before antibiotics? I would like to answer that for you. People died. Okay. It doesn't mean you have to take antibiotics. I'm just saying, like, people need to understand that people died. So.
Correct. Yeah. And, but that's what's, it's really cool to me. I imagine it probably a little bit more dramatic than it is, but I just imagine, like, the Kratt brothers are out there, like, trying to find like rare bacteria or, you know, substance, chemicals, fungus, things like that, that will produce the things that we need to make new antibiotics.
I think you and I should do that as a second career.
I think it's probably way more boring than you think. I think I would prefer this job.
We could make it more fun, though.
Yeah, but you can just make your life more fun. Like, if you want to scuba dive more, you can just go scuba diving more. You don't have to incorporate it into your job.
No, but what if you were scuba diving in a coral reef and taking samples and trying to find antibiotics?
That would ruin the dive for me. I'd rather just swim around.
All right, fair enough.
So, all right. So now let's talk a little bit about antibiotics and their mechanism of action. So how do these things work? Why do they kill bacteria or prevent bacterial growth? Some phrases that you're going to hear, some like terms that you're going to hear whenever people are talking about antibiotics are going to be broad spectrum versus narrow spectrum. So can you touch on that a little bit about, like, what's the difference between a broad spectrum antibiotic and a narrow spectrum? Why do we care?
Sure. So broad spectrum antibiotics typically have effects on a larger group of pathogenic bacteria.
Right. A broader group.
A broader group, if you will. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's try not to use the term in the definition.
Yeah,
you
know that's probably a good way to teach.
Yep, exactly. So anyway, so broad spectrum antibiotics cover a large group of bacteria. Narrow spectrum antibiotics are specific to maybe like just one, two, or three, like just a couple different pathogenic bacteria.
Why would I not always use a broad then?
Because of resistance, right? So if I'm the ideal situation is that, especially when people come to me in the emergency department, I don't know right away what kind of bacterial infection they have. If I suspect, based on their blood work and their symptoms, that they have a bacterial infection, I will put them on a broad-spectrum antibiotic because I want them to start getting better as quick as they can. And I'm going to have more luck if I'm using an antibiotic that covers more things. As soon as I get the cultures back, where, again, like I talked about, that Petri dish gets looked at and the pharmacist or the microbiologist calls up and says, hey, Dr. Seitz, this one specifically is going to be really – I should change it to a narrow-spectrum antibiotic. Because then what I'm doing is that bacteria will be killed by that antibiotic. Mm-hmm. We've already tested that in culture. If I continue to use a broad spectrum antibiotic, that bacteria may be able to evolve, and we'll talk about bacterial, antibiotic resistance, evolve in a way where, if the same bacteria later reproduce somewhere else, maybe now that broad spectrum antibiotic doesn't cover it anymore because it was able to adapt. So we're trying to, we don't want to give bacteria too much ammunition to continue to learn how to survive in the antibiotic world that we live in.
Yeah, we don't want to play our whole hand in the tactics of fighting right. these bacteria sort of thing. And the other thing too would be because it's a broad spectrum, it's killing bacteria that is healthy as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have bacteria in our gut, we have bacteria on our skin, like Chris was saying, we have lots of bacteria that works in our body that actually is very, I don't want to say symbiotic because it's not, but it's very beneficial to us to have that healthy bacteria. When we're on broad spectrum antibiotics, a lot of times those good bacteria get killed in the process too. And we want to avoid that whenever we can because we don't want to disrupt our body's function by wiping out all bacteria.
Yeah.
There's also opportunistic bacteria so I might have two bad bacteria in my body. One is causing this big response where I'm sick, right? And by using a broad spectrum and killing that, maybe I have a very more narrow spectrum specific bacteria that now has the opportunity to grow and cause more issues. Sure. So
anytime you kill off the good bacteria, you're leaving room for either that same good bacteria or other bacteria that may not be good to reproduce and have space, right? If there's not enough space or not enough, if you got a bunch of good bacteria growing, bad bacteria can't grow. There's already good bacteria there. If you get rid of the good bacteria, now there's room for that bacteria to grow. I mean, and women are more familiar with this than men in the sense that if you think about yeast infections, right? It is very common for women to be put on an antibiotic and then be like, oh, but I'm going to have to take an antifungal or something like that because I'm going to get a yeast infection. That happens all the time. That's that problem. It's not because, you've given, it's very normal for women to have vaginal candidiasis, yeast and good bacteria growing. That's normal. But when we kill off all the good stuff,
it moves into that neighborhood.
Yeah. Now all of a sudden we get, the inappropriate reproduction of candidiasis and things like that. And now all of a sudden that happens all the time. We have to be very careful about this with all antibiotics. You know what I mean? We have to, again, steward the use of our antibiotics well so that we don't develop these strains of bacteria or strains of, pathogens that it doesn't affect anymore.
And I feel like you can almost consider it in a marketplace, almost if you eliminate all of one thing, the competition moves in and expands it and it's going to fill that marketplace, mm-hmm. right? If I wipe out all the McDonald's, I'm now going to be dealing with a bunch of Taco Bells.
Or Burger King. Or right. Wendy's.
Right. But if I, Arby's. Okay, so let's say I give a broad spectrum antibiotic that takes out burger places, now I'm stuck with Taco Bell or and Arby's. Taco Bell is everywhere.
Or Arby's. Roast beef.
Okay, do you want Arby's after this?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So that's kind of the difference between broad spectrum and narrow spectrum. So that's broad spectrum versus narrow spectrum. Whenever we can, we want to try to use a narrow spectrum, right? I refer to this in previous podcasts all the time as a shotgun method of treatment when we use a broad spectrum because we're killing with a shotgun. There's going to be some
collateral damage.
Yeah, collateral damage. Narrow spectrum would be like killing with a sniper rifle mm-hmm. or a knife up close wow. right in the neck.
Wow. All right.
Okay, so now let's talk about gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. Because that's something you hear a bunch about. So there's different types of bacteria. There's gram-positive, there's gram-negative, there's anaerobic. There's weird stuff.
So we can classify, bacteria based on, and we'll talk about what they're based on, but we can classify bacteria in different ways. And the reason we classify, we talk about this a lot too. Why do we classify or define things in medicine? Usually it's because a certain treatment or a certain protocol or something like that. So we define bacteria as gram-positive, gram-negative, anaerobic, that type of thing, because that helps us then group them into categories where we know antibiotics will work. Mm-hmm. So how antibiotics work is can be multifocal, right? So an antibiotic can work on a cell wall, on the inside of a cell, on the like there's so based on that, we have to group bacteria based on what essentially they look like, if you will, so that
their
we know which
structure and function.
Yeah, their structure and function, so that we know which antibiotics will affect them. Because the antibiotics are not just coming in like Pac-Man eating these things. That's not how it works, right? They have to directly affect a certain aspect of that bacteria to kill it. And if it doesn't have that aspect, that antibiotic won't work for it.
Yeah. So if you just to get really break it down to basics and give you just kind of a high level view, like gram-positive bacteria is different than gram-negative bacteria, because basically where it has like a membrane, basically like the structure of the walls of that bacteria, you could say the walls are it's like slightly different. It's just like how the outside of that cell.
And the only reason that matters is because of how antibiotics work.
Exactly. Right. The only reason we would care is because Chris might look and say, okay, this type of infection is a gram-positive bacteria, and I know that this antibiotic works better on gram-positive bacteria, or vice versa, right? Gram-negative bacteria. I need something that's going to be able to fight this better. So it helps you just kind of understand the enemy a little bit. The last thing, like definition-wise, that I want to talk about is bacteria or antibiotics are either bactericidal or bactericidal. Bactericidal is it kills the bacteria. It actually eliminates the cell. Bacteriostatic meaning stop, it slows the growth of bacteria so that our body can, it interrupts the function of the bacteria to be able to replicate or grow, and therefore our body has a better chance of winning that fight because we've diminished the troops on the other side.
I like to remember that like homicidal means you kill humans.
Yes.
Homostatic means that you're like such a negative person that you slowly kill people with your negative thoughts.
You discourage them so much that they don't want to reproduce.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
Then you have to deal with less people later.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So sad world versus kill the person.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Got it. So there are five basic mechanisms of antibiotic action, and we'll kind of go over each one.
Well, really quick, we said we were going to define gram-positive and gram-negative because those are common ones that you hear of. So do you want to, so gram-positive bacteria consist of a cytoplasmic membrane surrounded by a tough and rigid mesh called the cell wall. Okay. You don't really have to remember this, but it's like for people to understand. Gram-negative bacteria have a thin cell wall, but then that's then surrounded by a second lipid membrane called an outer membrane. So the antibiotics have to work a little bit differently for gram-positive and gram-negative because they're what the barrier they have to get through to affect structure. That cell is different.
Cool. Yeah. So five basic mechanisms of actions that antibiotics employ. And there are a lot of nuances to each of these. So I just want to clarify, like Chris and I are not microbiologists, right? And we're not pharmacists. I would say we casually are.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm a
not professional.
I'm a not professional microbiologist. Right. I'm a recreational microbiologist.
Exactly. Like, for instance, I have a lab similar to Alexander Fleming's where it's kind of a mess, but because I know that could produce really profitable results.
The purpose
results
of the lab is to keep it messy so that you can find something new.
That's why I tell Natalie all the time why I don't, like, keep our room clean and, like, you know, clean ever really anything. And she's always like wanting to clean stuff up. And I'm like, no, leave it. What if we discover a miracle drug?
Right. You never know.
Like a fungus from my shoes could save lives.
Exactly.
We won't know.
Why go out into the jungle when you could just find it in your shoe? When you just find the same thing in your shoe.
So, yeah, just to preface this a little bit, like we're not experts in this area. We're going to give you kind of higher level explanations of,
you know what we're going to do,
of how antibiotics fight bacteria, but like there are nuances within that. So like even within like the inhibition of cell wall synthesis, there are
multiple ways you could do
that. Lots of different ways to do that. Mm-hmm. So there's more specifics to this. Mm-hmm. I just don't think for the purposes of the medical providers that we're trying to kind of educate on this, they need to get that in depth without.
Correct.
If you want to go be a microbiologist, go be a microbiologist.
What we're going to do is take it back to basics.
Take it back to basics. That's what we do. Yep. All right. So we'll start with that inhibition of cell wall synthesis. So this is a bactericidal technique.
So this is one of five, right? So we're kind of covering five. So the first one is inhibiting the cell wall
Synthesis is what I just said. Yeah.
No, be able to make the cell wall.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we can destroy the cell wall by preventing it from being able to be created. So here's the thing. There's a couple ways that we mess with the cell wall. One of that is, the, like you said, the synthesis, the creation of the cell wall. Why do we want to do that? Because if we can open the cell wall up, contacts are going to come in and out. And that's going to – yeah, the cell could die from that. Also, you could also basically open up holes large enough for, like, our immune response to get in there and kill things.
Okay.
Explain how this works. And this is how penicillin works. So penicillin would be an example of a antibiotic that inhibits cell wall synthesis. But basically, the cell wall is made up of peptidoglycan layers. So the idea is if we can inhibit the enzymes that either create these layers or we can reduce the cross-linking of the peptidoglycan-stabilizing proteins, we'll loosen up the cell wall enough, make it vulnerable, and then we'll have a better chance of it dying.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, think about it as like, you know, a castle, right? You have a castle wall. You can either kill the people trying to build the castle wall, right? That's like what vancomycin does. That's the whole, like, inhibiting the enzymes that create the layers. Or you can, like, disrupt the bricks of the wall.
Yeah, like you can dissolve the mortar.
Yeah, right, exactly, right, yeah.
Stabilizing process.
And that's what, like, penicillin does. So you can see that even in, I think what you were commenting on before, even within this realm of, like, inhibiting the cell wall synthesis, which is one of the five ways antibiotics can work that we know of today, there's multiple ways we can do that, potentially.
And different meds are going to be better at different things, and it kind of all depends, again, on the bacteria, which one we're going to pick.
Right.
So now what happens is the cell, if we can interrupt that wall, the cell can't divide, which is good. It can't reproduce, right? It's vulnerable to anything that could come in or out of it, which encourages its death. Doesn't necessarily, it's not like it explodes it. Like in the way our immune system, when we talked about our immune system, it was like more fun because it was like, oh, this cell comes and it injects stuff in and then it explodes. Right? But it's not really that. It's just loosening it up and encouraging an environment where the cell will truly die. Yeah. Other, like, bacterial static mechanisms are more like now the cell's still there. We didn't kill the cell. It still exists, but it can't produce. It can't reproduce. Mm-hmm. It can't divide. It can't, you know what I mean? So now,
which, again,
now
just, the reproduction is kind of one of the most important pieces, right? Your body eventually will get rid of pathogens. Mm-hmm. Things that don't belong there, your body will get rid of. Where our bodies get overwhelmed is when the bacteria is reproducing so quickly that our body can't keep up. And that's where antibiotics come into place to either start helping our immune system kill and or slowing it down so our immune system can take care of it.
Yeah, which is interesting to me because, like, we talk about the cure. The cure for this is this medicine. And, like,
the body is always the cure.
Your body is always the cure. We're using basically just new tactics in order to help.
And we've talked about this a bunch of times on podcasts. Like, our job in medicine through therapies and medications and, like, is to help the body get back to homeostasis. Is to help the body. So, like, there's not homeostasis when a bacteria is reproducing faster than our immune system can handle it. So what do? We give antibiotics to either slow that down or help it kill it to help our bodies get back there. So
exactly.
Your body is the cure.
Body is
that
the
should
cure.
Be the new name.
Back to basics. Podcast. Welcome to Back to Basics. The body is the cure.
Body is the cure. I'm going to write that book. TM. If you just say TM, does it work? Or do you got to actually, like, apply for that trademark?
I'm no lawyer, but yes. All right, so then another mechanism that can happen is the inhibition of protein synthesis. Sometimes these cells are bactericidal. Sometimes they're bacteriostatic. That's these cells, these antibiotics. But basically, if we can interrupt the ability of the cell to make proteins,
then it can't reproduce.
The cell can't reproduce or it'll die.
Yeah.
Right. So an example of this would be like a Z-Pak, azithromycin. There's a couple different forms of this, but, like, one way that this happens is if you guys remember from your cell anatomy in school, you remember ribosomes? Ribosomes use, like, mRNA in order to synthesize proteins. So sometimes we can, like, mess with the mRNA. Sometimes we can mess with the ribosomes. Sometimes we can mess with the later process of when it's putting the protein together. So there's different little parts of that process that we can mess with in that protein synthesis. And now the cell can't make proteins and it's done.
Yep.
Right?
Like it.
So that's one example. Azithromycin or a Z-Pak, which is pretty common. I feel like I've been on that antibiotic like every time I've been sick.
Azithromycin is a good broad spectrum antibiotic.
It's pretty broad.
Yep. So the third one, so we talked about inhibiting the cell wall synthesis, so stopping the cell wall from being created, inhibiting protein synthesis, excuse me, stopping proteins from being created. And then there's the third one, altering the cell membrane.
Yeah, right? This is where things get kind of cool, I think.
Yeah.
Like,
go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're excited about
it. What happens here is to me it's more like military like tactics on the cell membrane, right? So like the outer layer, the wall of the cell, if we can interrupt that again, we can cause damage. So there's a couple ways that this can happen. Two of which that I thought were really cool. One is creating like efflux pumps. So basically like this antibiotic will create a hole, like a pump. It'll build a pump into the cell membrane and like pump stuff in that'll kill the bacteria, which I think is really cool.
That's cool.
To me, it's like a siege tower.
Yeah.
Everything to me goes back to like military. Same. So it's like a siege tower, right?
Trauma we have around that for some reason. Yeah, but yeah, that's exactly. Definitely where my mind goes to.
So daptomycin is an example of that. Then there's like polymyxins, which is a kind of like almost like a class of antibiotics. Right. Yeah. So polymyxins use a cationic detergent that binds to the membrane and increases the membrane's permeability. So it like basically like
sound wave, it just starts like shaking everything up.
Or like we were saying earlier, like it like loosens the mortar, right? It's truly like a detergent that like starts to like just kind of make the cell membrane weaker and possibly be more prone to holes and stuff like that. And that way, if we can invade that wall, we can win. So that is a bactericidal mechanism. It'll kill the cell. It doesn't necessarily interrupt the production, and that is altering the cell membranes. So one more time, inhibition of cell wall synthesis, don't let the wall be built. Inhibition of protein synthesis, don't let the things that make all the things that work be built, right? That's like launching a diseased cow over the walls.
That's like a Trojan horse, killing, because
you're killing the workers, right?
Yeah.
And then...
That's just sieging it and everybody's starving to death inside.
we'll have to attach like an infographic that's like our complicated analogies to whatever. But
then there's altering the cell membrane.
So now we have inhibition of nucleic acid synthesis.
So in my mind, this is similar. You can either inhibit proteins from being created, which is what the bacterial cells use to create everything it needs, mm-hmm. or you can inhibit its ability to make its own DNA or RNA, which now it can't reproduce, right?
Right. And which is also very similar to our final one, which is anti-metabolite activity. Like basically this stuff works on the production of the DNA and the RNA. If we can mess with that, like remember nucleic acid, like DNA, your DNA is chains of amino acids, right? Mm-hmm. Amino acids?
I don't know.
Nucleic acids. Anyway, that's how they reproduce, right? It's how you become you, and you, chromosomes, and you're able to divide. Nucleic acids.
A, G, C.
Yeah, so if you remember the Jurassic Park picture of that DNA coming together, right? If we can inhibit the chaining of that, those can't even come together. There's like some cool antibiotics that actually like allow DNA and RNA to like be built into chains, but then won't ever connect the chain. It like prevents the connecting of those chains. Yeah. So they're just kind of always.
And that clearly then is a big bacteriostatic mechanism, right? That's going to stop it from reproducing. It's not going to really kill it. It's not going to, it's not going to be able to, it's just going to be by itself now.
Yeah. And then hopefully our immune system comes and gobbles it up.
Right.
So those are the five: inhibition of cell wall synthesis, inhibition of protein synthesis, alteration of cell membranes, inhibition of nucleic acid synthesis, and anti-metabolite activity. So all of these will work to kill or prevent the reproduction of
bacteria.
I keep almost saying antibodies, which would just confuse everybody, right? It. Yeah, of bacteria. Cool. That's kind of how antibiotics work, right? Now let's talk just a brief moment. This is not a lecture about antivirals or about viruses, but just to give you kind of a brief idea of why we can't employ the same mechanisms to defeat viruses, right? Number one, viruses don't have a cell wall. Like all of this has to do with kind of invading the cell wall, getting inside there and doing that. Viruses don't have a cell wall. It's a totally different thing. Viruses actually, like, they'll attach to a host cell and then they'll be viral entry. So they'll burrow a hole into our cell wall. Then they'll send in their DNA and RNA. They'll release their genome. It'll replicate.
They use our cell's functions to reproduce its own DNA and RNA.
They take over. That's... like a Trojan horse, right? So they Trojan horse us,
right,
and get in and start doing that, which is why Trojan horse viruses from science movies about computers. Mm-hmm. Nailed it. But anyway, they replicate then, and then eventually that virus spreads within our cells, bursts our cells, releases more viruses. Those viruses then go and attach to other cells, and it spreads that way. So a totally different mechanism of how the enemy works. So we have to employ a different way to defend against it. And I would say that antivirals are more, like, if we want to use that analogy, are more of a defensive tactic than they are a, like, offensive tactic, where we're not really, to my knowledge at least, I'm not an expert on antivirals, but, like, we don't really send something out to go attack the virus and kill the virus. We interrupt those.
Our body will do that. Our immune system will do that.
We interrupt the ability for the virus to replicate and attach to our cells. So, like, we'll stop for attachment to host cells. We can give antivirals that basically create a blocker so that the host cell can't be penetrated. Mm-hmm. So we'll do something like that. Or viral entry. Sometimes we can give antivirals that will prevent it can attach to the cell membrane, but it won't get through the cell membrane when it inserts. The release of the genome, the replication of the viral genome, like, once it gets in and starts trying to take over our systems, we can prevent that. So, like, we basically take its attack tactics and we defend against those and then let our body handle the virus. Yep. So a little different. One of the major ways that you can defeat viruses too is, as Chris mentioned earlier, vaccines.
Well, and vaccines aren't necessarily – I would almost say vaccines are not – defending you against viruses in the same way as antivirals are, right? So what vaccines to me is essentially you're giving your cells like one of those wanted posters. Yeah. No, for real. Like, you're giving them a wanted poster and there's a picture on it. They're like, okay, that's what that guy looks like. And then when the virus shows up, it just immediately attacks it and takes care of it, as opposed to it doesn't recognize it and there's been time for that to, like, reproduce a bunch of times.
Yeah. Vaccines are a way to basically fast forward in time and say, my body has already fought this, so it has developed it has developed ways to fight this, recognizes it, knows it. We got a picture of the horse. So they're not gonna Trojan horse us, right? Because we know if a horse shows up at our walls, not to let it in, right?
And that's where sometimes I think people get scared, because they're like, oh my gosh, like, this vaccine has a virus in it. Well, like, yes, not the whole virus. It has a part of that virus's gene. You have to give. It's almost like a dog, where you, like, the dog sniffs something and then it goes hunt. It's the same kind of thing. You're giving yourself something from that person, something from that virus to recognize, so that when they see it again in the future, they take care of it right away.
Yeah.
So, like, it's. I feel like sometimes people get worried that, like, oh my gosh, like, they're actually introducing the virus into my system. Like, yes, absolutely, 100%. That's the point. That's the purpose of what we're trying to do.
But right? It's not a vial of the virus, like Mission Impossible 2, right, where we're trying to, yeah. And sometimes you'll have symptoms when you take a vaccine. Mm-hmm. And that's not because you have
an infection.
That infection in the way that you would understand it. Yeah. You're basically, your immune response is responding to these new instructions.
And we want that. Because we want immune response to train so that when the infection pathogen ever shows up, it attacks it the same way and we don't have to get sick. So.
Otherwise, like, the response to polio is like, give them polio.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. So that's kind of the difference between antivirals. And again, we'll do another lecture sometime about, you know, really talking about the specifics of how antivirals work and stuff. I'm not well versed on that right now, so I would need some time to do that. But that's the big difference. And I like thinking of it as kind of that offensive versus defensive tactic a little bit, because all of our antibacterial mechanisms involve the antibiotic going and hitting the cell that is the bacteria. A lot of our antiviral stuff is basically preventing ourselves from being penetrated by interrupting the viral,
right,
the virus piece, you know, hitting us and trying to stop it from invading. So yeah, cool. So that brings us to kind of our final topic here: antibiotic resistance and how that can develop and why that's such a big threat. So we've touched on this a little bit already, but
cells adapt. I think it starts there, right? Your cells adapt, and because bacteria are cells, they adapt. So if we are introducing the same bacteria, and when I say same bacteria, I'm not talking about like one cell. I'm talking about one bacteria that has replicated a million times. It's the same DNA. It's like, you know what I mean? Like, just as our children adapt to, right, as we like go through generations, so do bacterial generations adapt. So if we keep introducing the same antibiotics over and over and over again to the same lineage of bacteria, there is a chance, and we see this happen, where bacteria learn how to not be affected by that anymore, right? So if I'm giving you an antibiotic and it keeps punching holes in your cell membrane, and you have the time, one, to continue to replicate and learn, then eventually you find a way to use a stronger wall that I can't punch through anymore. And that is essentially the whole, like, that is what antibiotic resistance is. But that time component is a really important part. So I want to touch on that part first, because a bacteria that's dead can't learn, right? A bacteria that's dead and then, like, is just gone now, like, doesn't have a lineage to carry on its memory of that antibiotic. This is why it's so important when we tell people as physicians, like, take the full course of your antibiotic.
Right. Don't stop when you feel better.
Day five.
Yeah.
If we gave you 10 days, take the full 10 days. Because here's the thing. You may feel better at day five, but there's still a couple bacteria left in there. And they remember the antibiotic. What we're trying to do is to try to kill so many of them or all of them where, like, there's no memory of that antibiotic even being reproduced. So the next bacteria that infects you is not that. But those bacteria, if we leave bacteria behind with that quote-unquote memory, and down the line they get the opportunity to start replicating a million times over again, they have that memory. And that's where we're going to start seeing antibiotic resistance, and where we have started to already see in our society antibiotic resistance. Strains of bacteria, right?
It's complete annihilation of the enemy so that we don't leave stragglers where they can build up another little rebel alliance and try to take us out again, right? So, and that's the thing, is I think some people think, like, take the full 10 days because if you don't, you won't get better. That's not true. You will get better. Your immune system will probably take that out. But the problem is you have potentially created a version of this bacteria that's resistant to those antibiotics. Right. And it can transfer that data, and that can spread.
Mm-hmm.
So, because now what happens is when Chris walks by and he coughs and he doesn't have much, he's finished half a regiment of Vanco, you know what I mean? But he coughs and I get some of the bacteria that he had. That bacteria is ready to fight Vanco. It's ready to go. So when I introduce Vanco, it's not working as well, right? So just something to think about. A couple different...
It doesn't happen like that. Like, that is how it
continues. It's a very elementary
example. Yeah, that is how it continues to transfer. But you'll see things in the news like, hey, like a strain of a bacteria broke out that's resistant to this. That's what it's talking about. It's passing on. It's continuing to pass on bacteria that are starting to learn and gain memory. And that's why, like I said, finishing the course of antibiotics and using narrow spectrum antibiotics when you can. When you know what's going to work, only use that one. Because on the off chance that some of that bacteria survives and you pass it to somebody else, it only knows that one narrow thing, not this broad thing over here, right?
Yeah. And again,
don't let the bacteria learn.
Well, again, like, I'm glad that you're using things like memory, like memory and learning and that type of thing. That is a very high level elementary way to explain it. So people are going to,
the way bacteria learn is the same way that, like, any creature adapts. It's through genetic mutations, right? So, like, you alter, like, the bacteria that survive are the ones who are more apt to do. I mean, I can give it more complicated, but that's just going to...
Yeah, sure. We'll just leave it at that. I mean, generally, that's what we're talking about when we talk about how bacteria's ability to adapt or resist. So... How does this resistance transfer? There's a couple of mechanisms. One's transformation, which is basically like when a bacteria is destroyed, it leaves its DNA and RNA kind of like floating there, right? And then another bacteria can like get that. And then it's like, oh, here's like a videotape of how they fought and they lost. So, you know what I mean? So that's one way of doing it. There's conjugation, which is almost like a sexual reproduction, where essentially it reminds me of like in a space movies when a spaceship comes and it has a little docking thing.
Yeah.
So there's like a little docking thing that goes from one bacteria to the other and they can transfer.
That reminds you of a spaceship docking, not a penis?
Well, no, because it doesn't, there's not a hole that it's going.
I'm like, you went straight to space, but when sexual conjugation and a little thing comes out, you didn't think.
Man, I don't need to try to act like I'm like I had a wife. We've been married for almost 10 years now. Like, I'm not trying to impress.
This is not in your mind.
Sorry, I got spaceships on the brain. So then there's transduction, which is bacteriophages are released. So if you think of it like a spaceship, it's like it's sending little
pods.
Yeah, like it's sending like the TIE fighters out, right? The Star Destroyer is sending all the little TIE fighters out. The TIE fighters are landing on the new spaceship and transferring data that way. Okay. And then there's like true binary fission or replication where like the cell splits and obviously it has a memory through what you were talking about. Like it actually remembers. So, so ways that we can prevent antibiotic resistance. Wash your hands.
No, so, I mean, the first one we talked about, like I said, where we can use narrow-spectrum antibiotics. Yes. So we can start with broad-spectrum, but as soon as we know what that bacteria is susceptible to, we should be changing to a very narrow-spectrum antibiotic.
Well, true, yeah. And I think, too, you're speaking from an emergency physician mindset,
sure,
too.
Sure.
So, like, I don't go to my PCP and they're like, I'll start you on a broad spectrum and then I'll work you down to a narrow spectrum. You do that in the ER because you're dealing with typically very ill people, right? So, like, that's where, like, if you go to your PCP, they're like, hey, I'm going to do a strep test on you. It sounds like you might have strep throat. Right. I do a strep test. I can very quickly know you have strep. I'm going to give you this narrow spectrum.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, for strep, right? So, like what Chris is describing is a little bit more of an emergent, like somebody is dying from an infection. Let's hit them with a broad spectrum and then we can narrow it down. In a lot of cases in your life, when you deal with bacterial infections, you'll be able to discover the narrow spectrum right off the bat.
I think there's things that we can do as patients to to help prevent this. And there's things that we can do as healthcare providers. Right. So I think as patients, to your point, like not asking for or demanding an antibiotic for every single thing, right? Yes. Recognizing now hopefully we understand as patients or can educate our patients on why we don't just jump to an antibiotic anytime you call up and say, hey, my nose is running, right? Mm-hmm. We want to be careful of that. I think patients also, I mean, yeah, obviously regular like washing your hands and staying healthy, that type of thing. Two, isolation. We did this a lot with COVID, right? With COVID, it's like you're supposed to isolate for 10 to however many, 80 days. It changed a bunch. You know what I mean? Like, that's an important thing even when you are just have a quote-unquote normal upper respiratory effect. Like mm-hmm. not getting other people sick is like a really nice way to, you know, prevent antibiotic resistance and also just to be a nice person.
Well, and how we quarantine in the hospital, right? Like in our ICUs and things like that, especially when like super bugs are being developed and super resistant bacterial infections are developed because you have someone who's been in and out of the hospital their whole life. So they're getting these kind of these nice petri dishes of bacteria that are all kind of talking, if you will. But so making sure that you're like – in and out of a patient room, you're washing your hand, you're doing the hand sanitizer, you're like making sure that you keep those patients separate. You're not allowing, you know, sometimes we have to be careful with visitors and stuff like that. Like how we do all of that to make sure that we're not, you know, spreading lots of different types of infections among the sick at the hospital or at the doctor's office.
The other thing I think we need to be cognizant of as healthcare professionals is that like this is why it's so important to do the steps to like figure out what the actual pathogen is, right? It's very easy for us to just be like, well, take an antibiotic. Here's an antibiotic. Here's an antibiotic. I think that there is a level of responsibility we have to say, okay, you know what? We'll use your strep example. Either I'm gonna swab you for strep, and if it is negative, I'm gonna educate you and not give you, whether you're mad or not, right? Or there's like maybe I don't have the ability to do a strep test right now, but there are criteria. There are lots of tools that we can, like CENTAUR criteria for strep infections. If you have 3 to 4 of these 5 symptoms, then statistically you're more likely, and we should. But if you don't, then you statistically do not. And I think like we have to. It's again a lot of times easier just to throw antibiotics at our patients because that's what they want, and because educating is hard. Mm-hmm. And I think taking the responsibility of educating our patients and stewarding antibiotics well as healthcare professionals is a very, very important piece of what we have to do.
Yeah. I think respecting the idea that it is possible for a primary care physician, when you come in with some complaints of a runny nose and this and that, to just give you a broad spectrum. They can order a broad spectrum antibiotic whenever they want and give that to you. But their due diligence is to, you know, take a look at symptoms, really assess you. Is this a virus? Is this a, am I suspecting a virus or am I suspecting a bacterial infection? If I am expecting a bacterial infection, what specifically is that? Are there tests I can do or short tests? This patient isn't going to die in the next 2 days if we have to wait for the results of a couple tests. So, you know, doing that due diligence and making sure that we don't.
And in the hospital setting, I think like doing cultures, right? Like it's one thing to say, hey, you've got a urinary tract infection. Here's a broad spectrum antibiotic and I send you home. Like I still probably should be sending cultures to the lab and making sure that there's a process in place that in a day or two, when the culture shows this, that I call you up or let your primary care doctor know, hey, we should probably change them now to this antibiotic so it's more narrow spectrum. Like that's an important piece. At least as an ER doctor, like I always have to remember like to also like culture, blood cultures, you know, respiratory cultures, urine culture, like to actually look specifically for what is the thing because – and that's why we do it, to find the antibiotic that's going to work best so that we don't build resistance.
Exactly. I think educating to these points is – educating the public is really important to these points because, like, there is a threat of – I'm not saying it's going to be the end of the world anytime soon. I'm just saying that there is a threat that if we – like I like that you said, if we're not stewards of this gift that antibiotics are, if we don't steward that well, we're going to lose it and – it can potentially be very, very dangerous. And I think just generally people just don't really understand how it works. So they rage against it. You know what I mean? You're a lot less upset about the side effects of your narrow spectrum when you realize that, no, I'm taking this narrow spectrum because it's protecting the lives of the public. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And honestly, like if you want your grandchildren and great grandchildren to like have antibiotics that they can use, like it's important. Like there is, and I said, not like from a, I don't want to scare people, but at the same time, there is a lot of data and research to say that if we're not careful, there are not any new antibiotics being developed.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that, like, there could be. We actually have found things that could make it, but there's no money in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no pharmaceutical dollars behind it that people are going to buy it, so we're just not developing it. And it's like this balance between the business of healthcare and the practice of medicine, we're like, we got to be careful. Like there,
which is why I think it's important for casual recreational microbiologists
like us to continue
our work in our home labs.
Exactly. Exactly.
So well, that's all we have for you. I think what we've just kind of in review, we were able to cover the different mechanisms of actions of antibiotics, talk a little bit about the history of antibiotics and what they are, what they do, talk a little bit about bacteria and how that differs from common things like viruses and fungi. And then talk about antibiotic resistance and why it's an important – why there's a real threat of that in the world and what you can do to do your part to prevent it.
Yeah, exactly. This was fun because I feel like when you take things back to basics, like the basic mechanism of how bacteria work and how antibiotics work, all of a sudden topics like antibiotic resistance make a lot of sense, right? And all of a sudden the things we do make a lot more sense. And that's always the goal of this podcast. So appreciate you guys listening. I got nothing else.
Yeah, get a CE for this,
yep.
Whether you're a nurse or an EMS provider. But if you're a nurse and you're listening to it really quick, it might be a month. All right, we will see you guys next time. Stay sweet.
Hey, guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continuing education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardianceme.com. 100% free CAPC credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.